As we all know, life can be pretty tough. We can get all hit with some pretty nasty curves, and it's not always easy to find hope. But I want to talk about a woman who wrote a poem. And in that poem, she talked about the hope that she found from really a very unlikely place. What is that? Well, that's what we're going to take a look at.
The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does.
Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. I want to talk about a Russian woman, a poetess named Anna Akhmatova. She was born in the city of Odessa in 1888. Basically, that's where my family first hailed from. She died in 1966. And, you know, Anna Akhmatova lived a pretty tough and miserable existence, mostly because she had lived under Stalin and had, like so many folks, suffered from his brutal dictatorship. Though she managed to stay out of jail, many of her family members and closest friends didn't. In fact, her son, her only child, was arrested again and again and again and thrown in jail, pretty much because he was linked to her. There were some periods when things in her life were better than in others, but for most of her adult life, she was on the fringes, her poetry not fitting into the communist dream of a socialist utopia. And oppression, marriage and divorce, sickness, poverty, depression, oppression, I mean, it goes on and on. Hers is hardly a happy story. Yet amid all this, she wrote a poem, which of all of her work, and I've read a lot of her work, this poem is my favorite poem. It's called Everything is Plundered, and I want to look at it today with you. And I'm reading a translation by Stanley Kunitz and Maxine and Max Hayward. It's called Everything is Plundered. Hence, notice the opening section here. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Notice what she's saying here. Everything is ruined. Nothing is left untouched. She wrote this in 1921, not long after the communists took over and began controlling or trying to control every aspect of life. And the communists, as we know, pretty too much ruined every aspect of life they touched as well. Notice the images that she used, or the words, betrayed, plundered, sold. Nothing is sacred anymore. Nothing was off limits anymore. So she starts out pretty much setting the stage, setting the background for what she is writing. Then she goes on. Let me read. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wings scraped the air. Wow. Death's great black wings scraped the air. That's a powerful image. And of course, it's obvious she's talking about the reality of death, which with the revolution was now even more prevalent and more in their faces than ever. The brutality and the violence of the Soviet revolution left untold millions dead, even at that early time. Little did she know once was coming, what was coming once Lenin died, got out of power and died, and Stalin got in. Death's great black wing was only beginning to do its scraping. Death, betrayal, plunder. Not a pretty picture, to be sure. Let me read some more. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wings scrape the air. misery gnaws to the bone. Whoa, another powerful image of bleakness, suffering, and pain. Misery even to the bone. This woman is despairing. And again, if you knew the story of her life, you would understand why she despaired. She had plenty of reasons, believe me, to feel sorrow. Let me read you now the rest of the poem. Well, let me read you the whole poem as a whole. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wing scrapes the air. Misery gnaws to the bone. Why then do we not despair? By day, from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined, dirty houses. Something not known to anyone at all, but wild in our breasts for centuries. You know, wow, what is she saying here? Amid all this suffering, all this horror, all this carnage, she's expressing hope. She sees something deeper, something beyond what appears on the surface of reality. She's looking deeper at the world, deeper at reality, deeper at something than more than just what humans are doing. That's what I believe is going on here with this poem. Amid all the pain, all the suffering, what does she see but cherries blowing summer into town? Cherries blowing summer in a town? I mean, what a beautiful image. What a beautiful metaphor. You know, in its own subtle way, it carries within it something wonderful, something so hopeful amid all this plunder. She sees something in nature, something grander and deeper and more lasting than the foibles and lies and sorrows of humanity. Cherries blowing summer into town. And she looks up at the deep, transparent skies. Wow, think of the night, the sky, looking up at the sky at night. That is, she is looking beyond what this world's offering. She's looking beyond Stalin. She's looking beyond the Cheka, beyond politics. By day, from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep, transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. Ah! I love that. Can you imagine? Glitter with new galaxies. I mean, you really can't look up in the sky and see our own galaxy, or at least not much of it at all, much less the glitter of a new one. But Anna Akhmatova, amid all the sorrow, she's projecting beyond the immediate death scraping of the air. She's projecting beyond what she sees. It's as if what she sees is only a symbol for so much more of what's out there. Again, I love this. She sees in the nearby woods cherries blowing summer into town. And then she looks up at the deep, transparent skies which burn overhead on clear nights. And she sees even beyond that. And she sees in these deep, transparent skies the glitter of new galaxies. In other words, she looks up there and she sees the hope of renewal, of a chance to start again, of something new and better and different than what this wretched world offers. You know, I find it so interesting that amid all this sorrow and suffering, that she could see something that gave her hope, that she could see something that gave her reason to believe, not to give up in despair, but to believe in something beyond this. You know, reminds me of a story that I read. I had a good South African friend who told me all the time he was talking about the author Lawrence von der Post. And, you know, I didn't know anything about this guy. I never even heard of him. But then I got some books by Lawrence von der Post, and And I loved him, even though, you know, he was a South African growing up in a total different environment, which different from mine. But I found some really beautiful things in the writings of Lawrence Vonderpost. And I remember he told the story. Vonderpost told the story about he was a prisoner of war in the Second World War. It was interesting. He had learned how he was a white South African. He learned how to speak Japanese. And then he was in the war, and the Japanese soldiers caught him and they were going to kill him. And then he started speaking to him in Japanese. And I couldn't believe this gringo was speaking Japanese. And so they put him in a prisoner of war camp. Of course, the prisoner of war camp was no picnic, but I guess it was better than being dead. But the point is, Vonderpost said there was a night when they said they were going to kill all the prisoners. The next morning, they were going to kill him. They said, well, what is he going to do? And he said that night, Vonderpost said there was this powerful rainstorm, this powerful wind and rain and thunder and lightning. And in this storm, Vonderpost sensed that there was something, there was a power out there way beyond human control. That humans, no matter how much they thought, they were not in complete control, that there was something bigger and beyond it all. And he drew comfort from that. And interestingly enough, he didn't die. They didn't kill the prisoners. Now, contrast that story to the story I read once about Willem de Kooning, the Dutch painter. He jumped ship many years when he was young and lived in mostly his life in New York and struggled as a painter most of his life. And then as he got older, he finally got rich and famous, and now his paintings sell for millions of dollars. But, you know, Vonderpost spent most of his time living in New York City. And if you've ever been in New York City, you know, you look up at the sky at night and you might see a lot of lights in the sky, but you don't see stars, okay? And then anyway, de Kooning was living for one summer. He was living out in North Carolina. And there was a story told how he was walking out in the woods at night. And he looked up at the sky at night and he was blown away by all the stars. And then he said to the person, he said, let's get out of here. He said, quote, the universe gives me the creeps. So he looked up at the universe in the sky and saw something that gave him the creeps. But for Anna Akhmatova, she looked up in the sky and saw something else. She saw something that gave her hope. And what else? What else did she write? She said, and the miraculous comes so close to the ruined, dirty houses. Something not known to anyone at all, but wild in our breasts for centuries. Whoa. You know, here is the essence of the poem. Here is where it all comes down to. I mean, look at the dichotomy here. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined, dirty houses. In other words, there's this pathetic human situation. There's this pathetic situation of her own life, the pathetic situation in her own country. It's all captured in this phrase about the ruined, dirty houses. I mean, that's profound if you think about it. I mean, what are our houses? They're where we are. They're where we live. They're where we eat. They're where we sleep. They're where we live out most of our lives. And what does she call them? And they are ruined and dirty because that's what so many lives are. Our lives are ruined and dirty, whether we've done it to ourselves or others have done it to us. Ruined and dirty, that's so much of humanity. But then, what does she write that is amid all of this? Amid all of this, she writes, the miraculous comes so close to the ruined and dirty houses. Ugh, I love that. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined and dirty houses. I mean, that, in other words, that is even amid the wreckage of our lives. Even amid the wreckage of our lives, there is reason to hope in the miraculous, to hope in something transcendent, to hope in something beyond the immediacy of this world, something beyond this world. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined, dirty houses, something not known to anyone at all, but wild in our breasts for centuries. Something not known to anyone at all. Notice that verb, known. Something not that anyone, something that we can't figure out with our minds, something that we can't rationalize, something that we can't explain scientifically, something that we can't prove, something that we can't analyze and parse, something in a sense that, quote, we can't know, if that's how you understand know. Yet there are other ways to know things. And she says, yet it's wild in our breast for centuries. Ah, I cut my finger off to have an image like that. I'm a writer. What a great image. Wild in our breasts for centuries. And in other words, what she's saying, it's there. It's real. It's there. We can't explain it. We can't understand it, you know, but it's there. It's not in formulas or explained with rational thinking. It's something deeper than that. Something more internal and more personal than what you can put out with numbers or formulas. You know, somebody once asked a scientist about something about creation, and he said, well, what do you think in your gut? To which the scientist thought he was being so smart. He replied, I try not to think with my gut. Okay, fine. In one sense, that's nice. But maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe we need a little more coming from here than coming than just what's up here alone, because there's an awful lot up here that the world doesn't translate through. There's an awful lot that this part up here can't totally understand. You know, there was a Frenchman named Blaise Pascal. Pascal lived in the 1600s, and he had amazing, died quite young, and he had a powerful conversion experience. And he had scribbled notes. He had scribbled notes over the years, over the time after his belief, you know, he became a believer, and eventually they were published as pensées, which is excuse my butchering the French, but it means thoughts, and just little scattered aphorisms that he wrote, and it's been a bestseller for centuries. And anyway, he wrote a famous line in there, which kind of, I think, is what Akhmatova is touching on with her poem. And what the line says is this, Pascal wrote, the heart has its reasons, which reason does not know. In other words, there are just some things out there that reason cannot explain. There are just some things out there that reason cannot fathom. You know, as human beings, we're capable of reason. We have the capacity to reason, to work things out logically. But I'm convinced that as human beings, we are not ruled by reason. We're ruled by our hearts. We're ruled by our emotion. We're ruled by what can't necessarily be quantified the way reason is. And I think that's what she is doing here. I mean, reason alone would tell her that you got nothing to hope for, lady, nothing to take comfort in. You have only misery and despair. That's all you've got. That's all you're going to get. And you're going to wind up dead in the ground. And yet what happens? And yet the cherries blow. The cherries are blown, or the wind is blowing. The cherries blow in summer. And new galaxies glitter in the deep, transparent sky. Galaxies that she can't see, yet she still imagines something beyond what she can see, beyond what she can reason about. You know, folks, we are heirs of the Enlightenment. We are heirs of a philosophy and worldview that placed a lot of stock in what human beings, using their reason, using their rationality, using their supposed potential for goodness, could accomplish in this world. And in one sense, some of these principles have done us very well. The philosophy of the Enlightenment has worked great. Helps us build computers and airplanes and bridges. I mean, it worked at one level great. But on another level, such as building societies based on these principles, I mean, many people argue that the French Revolution, which, you know, devolved into such terror and violence, was all based supposedly on the principles of reason and so forth. And the Russian Communist Revolution, which brought so much terror and so much violence, supposedly based on logic and reason. And the Chinese Communist Revolution, and on and on. And yet something is apparently very wrong here. Something didn't work with all these, right? And so we come back to Akhmatova, and we come back to her poem, where everything is plundered, everything but a hope that's been wild in our breasts for centuries. Yet it's there, wild in our breasts. But where does it come from? Why should we hope? In nature, in the cherries that blow summer into town, in the glitter of new galaxies? What hope is there in a new galaxy when we can't get beyond our own solar system, much less our own galaxy? A solar system and galaxy that is, if the scientists are right, tell us is doomed to extinction anyway. You know, I don't know exactly what Akhmatova's deepest intent with her poem was, other than she reached out and saw hope beyond the immediate misery of her situation. And yet at the same time, I ask, what was this hope in? What was this hope based on? You know, I once read a story about this hardcore atheist philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre. He spent his whole life denying the existence of God and then trying to work out the moral consequences and implications of that denial. The story goes on to say that on his deathbed, Jean-Paul Sartre laying there goes, "I die in hope." Okay, that sounds real nice. I die in hope. Okay, fine. But then, supposedly, the story goes, he uttered words that stunned those who heard them. He said something to the effect of, "But hope must be based on something." Well, that's a great thought, Jean-Paul Sartre. You're a little late in the game for it, but I guess better late than never. But you see, that's the bottom line. Anna Akhmatova expressed a hope. But the question is, what is that hope based on? Science? Well, what does science have in answering the really hard questions? Science prolongs our life a little bit. It has some ways made it more comfortable. Some ways it's helped us break down and understand the physical nature of things a little better. No question about it. But what good does science do for us in the real hard questions of life? Nature? Well, as I've expressed on this show before, nature itself, in and of itself, you know, we love nature and it's beautiful, but as it's constituted, nature, folks, isn't really our friend. Nature in and of itself leads inevitably to death. Nature as it's constituted now really is the enemy. That is nature in and of itself. On the other hand, there is something in nature. There's something there in the world, in the glitter of galaxies, that points to something else, doesn't it? That points to something beyond itself. And I mean, did nature create itself? Did the world create itself? I mean, well, what do you know that creates itself? What has ever created itself? To create itself, it means it would already have to exist to create itself. And I don't think that works. And yet this is what I think she's looking at. This is what I think she has to be looking at. Because she knows that the cherries blowing summers into town isn't in the long run going to solve the problems caused by Stalin. That the glitter of new galaxies, wonderful as they are in and of themselves, isn't going to save her family or friends from the gulag or from the ruined and dirty houses. And it's not going to ease the pain caused by death's great black wing. You know, I don't know what Akhmatova really, really meant with her poem. I'm not even sure she did, because we're dealing with something that was wild in the breast for centuries. And that doesn't sound like something that you could easily nail down. But in the end, I believe this was essentially a religious poem. It was, in her own way, I think, a modern version of the words written thousands of years ago by the psalmist, who declared, "The heavens declare the glory of God." You see, if you get right down to it, it's not nature itself that gives us hope. It's got to be what's behind it, what nature alludes to. You know, I know there are famines, there are earthquakes, there are diseases and all the rest. You know, and the stars on the sky offer us nothing in and of itself, but it's what's behind those stars that offers us a hope. If there's be any hope, any chance of salvation, of something beyond what this world offers us, then it has to be, in a sense, what is behind those stars, what is prior to those stars. It's not nature itself that offers us hope, but it's got to be what's behind it. You can say what you want and you can argue with me and that's fine, but I know all the bad things that are out there. But if you could for a moment peel away the negative things, peel away those bad things, nature in and of itself talks to us of a loving creator. It alludes to something good and great behind it all. You know, sure, so much has been ruined. So much is out of our reach. I understand that. But I'm saying if we look behind all this, we can see something. We can see the beauty there. We could see that there's something else behind just what we see. You know, I can't prove this mathematically. I can't prove this apodictically. I can't prove it at all. I just know there's something like Anna Akhmatova. I struggle with those Russian names. Something that's wild in my breast for centuries. I don't want to stand up here and present some wonderful picture about life as we know it. I know it's not like that way. I know, as Anna Akhmatova said, people live in the ruined, dirty houses. And that's the unfortunate lot of us in this pathetic world from now. But what I'm saying is that something in Anna Akhmatova was saying, since she pointed to something beyond all this, she pointed to something in nature as kind of a harbinger of something good, of something hopeful. You know, of something that we can hope for, not in nature itself, but because there's no salvation in those glittering new galaxies any more than in the cherries that blow summer into town. No, that hope, the salvation, the answers must come from the God who created all those galaxies, who created those cherries, who made that summer. In and of yourself, in and of ourselves, the situation is hopeless. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's black great wings scrapes the air. And even if everything isn't plundered, betrayed, and sold, death's black wing comes along and takes everything away anyway. But there's hope. It's not in ourselves. We didn't create ourselves, and we can't redeem ourselves. Only the God who created us. The same God who created the deep, transparent skies. The same God who created the glitter of new galaxies. He can give us the hope that poor Anna Akhmatova expressed so beautifully, if not in detail, but poignantly in her poem.